You're listening to Grappling with the Graphic with your hosts, Darji and Jennifer DeRoss. Coming to you from Capes HQ, this is the Undercover Cape Special, Grappling with the Graphic, episode number 3. I am Dodgy, and with me is Jennifer DeRoss.
Hello.
This is not your typical UCPN podcast. Some of the topics discussed in this podcast can be confrontational. Also note, we are not professionals in the fields discussed. We are just talking about our real life experiences. So this episode is going to be very dear to our hearts. It is basically the loss of a loved one. Jennifer, did you have anything you wanted to discuss before moving forward?
No, sounds good to me.
Okay, good. Thank you. So I'll just tell you a bit about my backstory in terms of the subject field. My father and I, we had an awesome relationship growing up, in particular our love of movies, which was his work for over 30 years. So he worked in the theatre industry. He brought celebrities. When we were living in New Zealand, we had the likes of Benny Hill or Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jack Nicholson, Willem Dafoe all came to New Zealand when my father was working the cinema, and that's when the cinema actually meant something. So my father was my role model, and I think a lot of it had to do with me just looking up to my father and being the obedient child. As a teenager, you know, our relationship derailed because I started to become more curious about life, asking more questions, and my father didn't think that I was allowed to ask these sorts of questions. So in my late teens, you know, our relationship then became turbulent, and you know, and we didn't really see eye to eye on a lot of things growing up. But one thing I did notice about my father, and it's something I noticed when I was working night shifts, I was already working my first job, and I heard him coughing each and every night. And I wasn't really one to go up to him and approach him and say, hey, Dad, like, you know, what's up with the coughing? I had to tell my mother. I had to tell my mother that he was coughing, like, really, really crazily at night. And she then heard it as well, and then we were like, you know, like, you need to go to the hospital. And then he went to the hospital, and he was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. So in saying that, you know, if you know someone that you know, who's part of your family, someone you love or someone you care about, and there are some, like, abnormalities within that person, I think it's really important that you find that courage within yourself and just tell somebody. You don't have to tell the person directly if it's not something you'd be comfortable with, but I do really think it's important that you go ahead and tell someone, you know. And it actually hit us hard because, you know, it was only, he was given 6 months. He lived 13 months, so I was really happy to spend that time with him, spent, you know, the last Christmas with him. And, you know, he was actually nicer to me knowing that, you know, I guess because our relationship bonded in the last year of his life because of the fact he understood the kind of person I am. What he believed or perceived me to be wasn't quite what I was. You know, I wasn't the rebellious, you know, drug-taking son who, you know, went on benders and things like that. No, I wasn't. I was just very opinionated. I was very curious about things. And you know, just the thing with cancer, and I mean, when I look back at it now, I remember him being 120 kilos, which is like 264 pounds, went down to 35 kilos, or in your measurements, Jennifer, 77 pounds. So it was a massive decline in weight. And I really felt that my mother, she really worked her butt off to help him and, you know, give him the ease of life. You know, and to conclude, I do believe spirits exist, because I remember as a kid, or even as an adult, when my mother loved driving, so we didn't argue with her when she went driving. So my father would sit in the passenger seat, and I would sit behind my father. On the day of his funeral, I just remember the last time I was standing behind him as he's good about climbing to the car, and he turns to me and says, "I think you need to jump in the front or climb in the front seat now." And I said, "Why?" And I said, "Where are you going?" And yeah, and then that was it. I never saw him in any of my dreams ever again, and it really hit home because it felt so real.
Yeah.
So that's my story. Do you want to talk about yours?
Yeah. No, that's really, I like that a lot. And it links up to my story in that you never know when you're going to be confronted with those that you love in ways that you don't expect. I ended up being really close with my great grandma in my high school years, which is not, I think, the way that things usually go, but her nursing home was less than a 10-minute walk from my high school.
Oh, nice.
There were a couple of other students who had grandparents and great grandparents that were at the same nursing home. And so a fair amount of us would go over there. And then, like, the guy that I went to prom with, his mom was the person who cooked all her meals and whatnot. Like, she became a big part of my high school experience. And you know, her health started to slowly decline over the years. She died when she was 90.
Wow.
And it was just pneumonia. Like, it wasn't anything major, but her lungs filled with fluid. And I went down to the hospital to say goodbye to her. And my grandmother, her daughter, was there and told me that she had already sold off all of her things. And at first, I was really, really mad about that.
Yeah.
And in fact, didn't speak to my grandma for a long time after that. But about a year later, I got a present from my mom, and it was one of my great grandma's rings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she found it at a pawn shop, and she recognized it immediately and knew how close we had gotten in her later years. And so, yeah, that was really a big deal to me. And I, of course, have it and wear it sometimes. She had much bigger fingers than me, so I wear it on a necklace.
Oh, wow.
But it really made me stop and think about what it actually means that all of her stuff is somewhere out in the world. It means that there are pieces of her that other people are enjoying. They may not even know that it's related to her in any way, shape, or form, but in a way, she's still kind of out there. And I kind of like that idea, you know? I never know if I'll run into something that was hers.
Yeah, that's amazing, and I do like the fact because if you just mentioned before about the bigger fingers, my instant reaction would be wear it as a necklace, and I'm really glad you are because it means you actually it's also closer to your heart than you actually
Exactly.
realize. It is, that's amazing. So
Well, nice when you can find ways to make them a part of your life still.
exactly, and always try to find optimism as well. Is that's probably my biggest take out of it. I mean, you could be around people who've sort of done bad by you over the years, but if you look at the nice things that they've done for you, it's a great segue to, think nicer thoughts.
Yeah, always.
Absolutely. So what we'll do, we'll like link it to our favorite segment, which is pop culture. As we know, we're big time nerds. Well, maybe I am, but
Oh, I am too.
okay. So, you have one that is really one that's dear to me, but I would rather hear it come from you, Jennifer.
Well, one pop culture, I know normally I'm comics gal, but in this case, a musician is my strongest connection to pop culture death, I would say. When David Bowie passed, I learned that my youngest son was a much bigger fan than I had ever expected.
Wow.
I knew that he liked David Bowie. He listened to the music. Labyrinth was one of his favorite movies. Like, he liked him a lot, but I had no idea that it would have such a big impact on him. And more than that, it had a huge impact on my little community. I had friends that immediately were like, "Nope, we're gonna watch all of David Bowie's movies and listen to all of David Bowie's music and just like make a night of it." Like everybody was having all of these big celebration of life events. Unfortunately, all of them were, more adult themed, late at night, alcohol involved, and things like that. Things that weren't necessarily I could bring my then 9-year-old son to,
Yeah, of course.
But then the city put on an event. It was part of Pride Week. And they had a whole thing where they played Labyrinth on a great big movie screen, and they had free popcorn, and they had a David Bowie cover band and a David Bowie themed fashion show, and like Cannon got his face painted with the giant lightning bolt, and it was just the most amazing thing, and it really made me think about how I never really got the whole celebrity death thing. It never really bothered me the way that it seemed to bother other people because I didn't know those people. I didn't really, it didn't feel right to mourn them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, true.
But in this case, it brought the community together and it really did become a celebration of life. And it made me learn a lot more about why my youngest son was so obsessed with him, and I think that it can be a positive outcome in the end. It might be painful for a long time, but it can also really bring groups of people together and really make you appreciate the things that those people have done that can cause those groups of people to come together.
Yeah, I totally get it. I mean, I guess the reason why it hurts so much is because he's been performing since like in the late 60s all the way until like last year. He actually released an album like 2 days before he died. Like, that's
I know.
ridiculous.
I
And
know.
the thing is, because of the longevity of the person, it's almost like they're invincible, because I remember him when I was a child. I remember my mum dancing to his music.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I mean, I remember some of the songs, but I went on a really long car ride from my mother's place back to my place, and she was playing David Bowie, and I was like, oh God. And then when I was listening, hear me out, when I was listening, I was like, did he sing Changes? Oh, did he sing Let's Dance? I didn't know that he actually sang those songs. I knew them. They were up there in my memory bank, but I wasn't putting a singer towards it, because I'm
How
used to him.
interesting.
Yeah, I'm used to him singing in the way he did as a Goblin King, that sort of that high voice. And then when I heard songs like Starman, which is very science fiction, Space Oddity, like, oh, those songs
These
just.
are my favorite songs.
Those two of my all-time favorite rock songs. And I was truly blessed because I managed to get the greatest hits on vinyl, because of, it was like the ultimate respect, I could give to the man. And yeah, and I think for him it came later in life, but it was truly an amazing feeling to be able to get your hands on that sort of record. But also too, it's also sad at the same time, because I felt deflated that day. I felt really, really disgusted, because it's almost like losing a family member that you may have known of, but haven't actually met. That's how it felt. I felt a really bit deflated that day. But yeah, no, it was yeah, it was. I'm really glad that that Cannon got to get his face painted, because I would have loved to get my face painted as well. That would be awesome. Get the Ziggy Stardust going. So I've got a question for you. What your all-time favorite David Bowie song?
See, I want to say the alligator song because that's what Cannon calls it. Honestly, I like Rebel Rebel.
Rebel Rebel, yeah? Nice.
Yeah. Now I love a lot of his work though, and I love how it's all so different. Like he's iconic for the best possible ways. He's always who he is, regardless of what he feels like. He is always David Bowie, and I appreciate the heck out of that.
Nice. Well, my favorite song is Space Oddity, because
Yeah.
I worked with a guy named Tom, and I always ground control to Major Tom, and he never got it, but I used to sing that line to him all the time when I called him. It was funny, but yeah, no, it's an amazing song.
It is. It really is. It's probably my second favorite.
Well, I feel a little bit better now, thank you. So my next one, the next thing I want to talk about, and it's also related to pop culture, but maybe on a different twist. Back in 2010, I got to meet the great, the late Joe Kubert. As his Kubert School came out to Supernova in Sydney, and I got the honor of meeting him. And I remember this to this very day, what he said to me, because I approached him, I was being a bit overzealous, I guess, in my approach. I was like, Mr. Kubert, I've got about 50 characters in my head, and I really want to put them into a comic book. I'm a writer slash artist, and what would you suggest I do? And he said to me, son, first thing you do is wear the writer's hat. And he's actually like, showing, like, it looks like he was like putting on a hat. And he goes, wear this hat, get your script up and running, take that hat off, put on the artist hat, and then draw. And I was like amazed. Like just those words alone was worth like none, the more the money could actually, you know what I mean? It was amazing. It was very adhered to my heart. And as you know, I was at Boston only a month or so ago, and I met Adam Kubert, whom I was a childhood fan as well. I'm more of a fan of his than his father, but I knew the social importance of Joe Kubert. So I went up to Adam, and I said, "Oh, I just wanted to let you know I actually met your father once in 2010, and he was amazing. And I know losing my own father, I wanted to share my condolences, and just wanted you to know that, it was really nice to have met him and also meet you." And I got some stuff signed, and when I walked away, I was talking to my friend Bud about it, and he goes, "Oh, you said you had the photo on Facebook, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And he goes, "Why don't you go back and show him?" I was like, "Oh yeah, that's not a bad idea." So I went back and lined up to get, looking like I was a fan getting autographs, but I actually had my phone ready, but my phone only had like 2% charge. So I ran over and I said to Alex or Al, Al Mega, I said, "Oh, can I borrow your phone or can someone take a photo?" And Arelis, his wife, goes, "No, that's fine. I'll take the photo for you." I said, "Oh, that's amazing. Thank you." So I ran back in the line, waited to, and I had my phone on airplane mode, making sure that my phone didn't go flat by the time I reached him. And then I said, "Oh, then it was my turn." I said, "I'm just back to show you the photo I've got with your father." And he was holding my phone in his hand, and I saw Arelis was like crying, that's how emotional it was. It was such a nice thing, and I just thought that was an amazing moment, and yeah, it was one I'll never forget. And then I said to him, "Do you mind if I get a photo taken with you?" And then yeah, then Arelis took the photo, which was amazing. But yeah, I'll never ever forget that moment. Probably in the history of my life, that was amazing.
She's pretty huge.
Yeah, it was pretty, it was nice. Yeah. So that's my that was my moment.
Yeah, a moment indeed. Oh my gosh.
Again, yeah, that was amazing. But to sort of flip it on its head in emotions, you've got a book that you wanted to discuss.
Well, I've got a couple of things that I think are interesting, but one comic that I think is particularly pertinent for this discussion is called Destroyer. So it's a story about a single black mother who brings her son back to life after he's been shot. It deals with death on many, many different levels, including, systemic issues such as racism, environmental issues. It's really, in a lot of ways, a reflection on mortality itself. And it ties really strongly into the Frankenstein mythos. So Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, or at least one of the theories of where she came up with the idea was in processing the death of her premature daughter. And then in the book itself, we have Victor Frankenstein, the doctor, and attempting to become a modern Prometheus, may or may not have been influenced by the death of his mother. It's pretty fast, but it does happen. And now we have a new Frankenstein in the lineage, who then, you know, once again tries to bring a child back to life. And I think it's really interesting because of the way that it deals with what grief can look like. We have the more classic sort of examples. We've got the mother having nightmares, experiencing a lot of anger and guilt even about the fact that her son was shot. But we also see a numbing aspect. So she's drinking and she's working really hard. And the working really hard, I think, is interesting because it shows how grief can also be a motivator. A lot of people become demobilized with grief, but it can also make you really focus on what the important aspects are that you need to move forward with. Not saying that her choices were great, but it is a good reminder of figuring out what's most important in your life. They also have an interesting little note. The story includes a worry doll. So this is a Latin American thing where you make a little doll and then you whisper your worries, your concerns, your anxieties, you know, whatever's bothering you, whatever would be keeping you up at night. And you whisper it into the doll's ear and then you put it under the pillow and it's supposed to like take those thoughts away from you. And so I thought that was an interesting sort of meditative way of dealing with that level of grief. Another thing that I really liked in that series is the shrine that she builds. I think that we've lost a lot of our shrine culture, but creating a space in the house that represents that person can make it feel like that person is still there. And I think it can be a really good way of, again, isolating the important aspects. So what are the things that you want to remember? What are the things that you want to carry through or carry forward after that death? And and really seeing it as a moment of restarting life instead of the end of life.
Totally. I did feel exactly what you mentioned before about the anger, especially with the police brutality, and I mean how real it is in this culture. Because, you know, being where I am, like, we do get the news from America, we do see anything related to police brutality, you know, whereas it's a kid being shot because he basically says, "I've got a gun." Like, I mean, in anyone's right mind, you don't shoot until your life is threatened. But by words, like, come on, like, You know when is the right time to make that fatal decision. And that's why it really angers me when I see these sorts of things in the news. But and I do like how
it's response to that. I mean, channeling that kind of, again, it's that motivator. So this is a seriously bad systemic issue. How do you process that? How do you move forward with that? In this case, Lavelle moves forward and writes this comic to bring awareness to it through an avenue that may not otherwise be acknowledging or working through those issues.
Yeah, and I was quite thankful to see that sort of avenue being used, because they could have said, "Oh, the kid just died of natural causes," or something like that. But this was a motivator, and this is why I think Joe Baker really wanted to work hard in rebuilding her son. Because you've seen it in other mediums as well, whereas you know, it's like holding on to a dead child. Like, the best example would be the governor from The Walking Dead. He's keeping his daughter alive because in his mind she's his last little piece of him, and keeping this little kid turned into a zombie in a, you know, in a cupboard is just, it sounds horrible from an outsider's perspective, but, you know, like,
Build an altar instead.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And you know that feeling of what it's like Like, we don't know what it's like to lose a child, but you don't know what the other person could be thinking, because I've seen, whereas like primates are still carrying the young even if they're decayed, because it's the fear of letting go is imminent. And yeah, and but all in all, and you made a good point of it, is about a lot of death, and there was a lot in this book that I read it and was like, oh my gosh, this is so crazily violent. But you've highlighted the importance, of what's been masked inside the book. There's a lot to it, and I think anyone who is looking for something a bit different, would should definitely check this out.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so I'll go into my book, which is a bit lighter. It's Fatal Attractions. It's also brutal in that aspect, but if you think about it, it's the 1990s, so they couldn't have that sort of graphics for the Comics Code of Authority. But this was a brutal crossover, more so known for its holographic covers. And I'm going to focus more on Wolverine number 75. It's Magneto's last strike for now. Colossus joins the Acolytes. Wolverine has his adamantium ripped out of his body. And after leaving Avalon, licking their wounds, the X-Men are trying to help Wolverine get back to Earth safely. Their ship is badly damaged, manned by Bishop, Quicksilver, Gambit, Rogue, Professor X, and Jean Grey. For me, the reason why this book was quite important, because if you look back to the Hellfire Club era, even when the X-Men were poisoned in Japan, Wolverine was always the X-Men to save everyone's behinds. And in this book was different because it was Wolverine who needed saving. And we as fans know how much we loved Wolverine, but we didn't realize how much the X-Men loved him as well, because we kind of saw Wolverine as sort of the bit of that douchebag in the corner, always speaking his mind. Doesn't listen to authority. He backchats the Professor X, backchats the Cyclops, and thinking that everyone else would have that sort of animosity towards him. But it was very important because you see a lot of that emotional state, especially based on the Claremontian era. With Chris Claremont, he had Sprite or Kitty Pryde with Wolverine for a period. Then we had Psylocke and Rogue for a period of time, and then most recently Jubilee. So we had all these X ladies or X, female X-Men who sort of looked up to Wolverine as their mentor over a period of time, and it was really nice to see that, the emotional aspect of losing the guy that you probably would thought that everyone couldn't care less about losing. So it was a really an important book, and I hadn't reviewed this for another podcast before, and I was just thrown by the amount of emotions in it, especially with Kitty Pryde. Like, she was broken, and I loved how Jubilee just like sort of like clocked her in the head and said, calm yourself. He wouldn't say this about you, or sort of thing. And I thought that was amazing because it showed that Jubilee's a little bit more feisty or a bit stronger than Kitty is. So, and especially Kitty's already moved up to that role now. She's a member of
Yeah, she's
Excalibur.
eating right now.
Yeah.
Like at the time.
Exactly. You know what I mean? But and one of the things that threw me as well was the typically stern Psylocke looking emotional, and that was amazing because you never would imagine seeing Psylocke cry. No way. And that to me was just amazing. But I suppose the concluding part of it was the fact that you had the letter to Jubilee, how Wolverine's goes on his own. And I think this is where the Wolverine book really picked up. I think Larry Hama and Adam Kubert had done an amazing job. I think that was probably the best story arc I've ever read about Wolverine, was him losing his adamantium and how he's like free game in the public. He's not no longer with the X-Men, he's not protected by the X-Men. It was an amazing run. So, I know I did a lot of talking. What were your thoughts, Jennifer?
For me, the letter was by far the most touching, and especially because one of the things that we like, Wolverine has been through so much. And you're right, everybody is really, really upset in this issue, which is something that you didn't expect to see. But what I thought was especially telling is how unupset Wolverine was. He was totally fine with it. And it's one of those, he's been through so much at this point that this is just another thing. Like he totally is able to just deal. He has built tough enough skin at this point that he can just manage. And in fact, somehow is the one that helps everybody else still. It just happens to be on an emotional level instead of a physical level at this point. That, don't be sad for me at the end. Like that so encapsulates the character for me. And I think it's a good reminder, like being aware of who the person is. Would this person want you to mourn? Would this person want you to live? Wolverine clearly wants everybody to move on with their lives because he's moving on with his life, Like I thought that was such a nice way to end it.
Yeah, totally. And the letter was very moving, and the pacing of the letters as well. It went
Oh.
over like 3 pages, and
Yeah.
and it was nice too, because Jubilee did wake up midway through the letter, which was kind of nice. So she got the grasp of it, and the wave goodbye just,
Yeah, yeah.
just topped it.
Getting to see him go off into the sunrise.
Yeah, but you mentioned before about Wolverine doesn't want you to mourn for him, but if you look back, probably 12 years prior was the Dark Phoenix saga. Wolverine did a whole lot of mourning when Jean died, but
That's great. But still,
yeah, he did a
okay.
whole lot of mourning,
At
but
this point.
yeah. But that's another story for another time. But that was very emotional. So you mentioned before you've got another book you wanted to discuss, or another topic?
We had talked about a couple of movies and whatnot. For me, it was a TV show that was the biggest. In fact, I can't even watch the episode very. It's probably I've watched The Body, an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 4 times, I think, total. It's a particularly rough one, and it's particularly rough because it feels really real. You've got a wide variety of reactions to what happens. Basically, Buffy walks into her house and she sees her mom lying on the couch, and you can tell right away that Joyce is not alive. And the whole episode, there's no music, and you know that it's buckle up for the ride. As soon as Buffy says mommy, like it's that powerlessness that hits. But every character goes through different reactions. Xander gets angry and punches a wall. Anya intellectualizes it. She's got one of the best speeches from the whole series, in my opinion, where she tries to rationalize how Joyce went from being Joyce to just a body. Like, really trying to grasp what that means and how that happens. We also see Willow, the best friend, trying to be strong like an Amazon for everybody else. And then we just see the shock that sets in for Buffy and for Dawn, the numbness, the not being able to tell if you're hungry or thirsty, kind of pacing around, the automatic phrases, she tells the EMTs good luck as they leave the house. Like it's that sort of like miscommunication, your brain's not quite firing off sort of things that you just those aren't as common to come across in media because they're things that are really hard to deal with. They're things that people don't want to deal with. But I think it's important to be able to deal with those issues and witness the various different types of reactions that you can have because you can't expect everybody to react the way that you react, and shaming or judging them for that can be really damaging. as Tara says, you know, it's different for you because it's always different. It also touches on, you know, how trivial it makes everything else feel, because normal life just continues around you. Like, it's as if nothing happened for anybody else because it didn't happen for anybody else. So you got that sense of isolation. But as much as it's a very frank and naked sort of approach to it, again, the no music makes every single thing hit so much harder. It also has these touching moments in this episode and the next one of how to actually deal with it. So, you know, we see examples of people taking time alone to process. We see, you know, things like journaling, so taking note of the important things that happen every day, because you never know when that's going to be the last day. You don't know what memories are going to be the memories that you want to hold on to. And then also being able to accept help from those that do love you, and how important physical contact is in situations like that. I highly recommend the video or the episode. It's one of those things that you might not want to watch, but I feel like everybody should watch.
Because would you say this is a way that people could react in real life that they may not be familiar with?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because there's no point in avoiding it. Like, and that's the thing. Death in its own way is inevitable. It's going to happen to anyone at any time.
Yeah.
And it's important that you don't mask, you know, hide yourself from it. Because if you do, you're not in reality. It's not a real world. If everyone lived forever, I mean, gosh, how great would it be? Probably wouldn't be great. And if you... I don't think I'd want to live forever. Gosh.
No.
See? And that's the thing. We have to embrace it. We have to take it as serious as it is. And I think media is a great way for us to actually get the hang of it. Like, it's terrible when you see these atrocities that are happening in other countries that involve genocide. That is not what I'm referring to. I'm talking about the natural, you know,
but both. I mean, this is the thing, is we live, which means we must die. We have to embrace that. We have to confront that. And lying to ourselves, I mean, that's just not going to work. You're still going to die. So.
Absolutely. So. Yeah.
I should warn you, I have a dark sense of humor sometimes.
Oh, sorry. Really? I did not figure that. All right, so we'll move on. So you have anything else you wanted to cover with that Buffy episode?
No, just watch it, really. Okay. It's one of those things that I think everybody needs to watch. It's something that can be as frank and open and honest about death. It is worth processing.
Yeah. So my next one is a movie based on a TV series or a cartoon animated series that I grew up with, both living in New Zealand as well as in Australia. And it was adhered to my heart because it was great. My father used to go to the video store and used to rent me VHS cassettes or even beta, if you can remember that far back. And it was Transformers. And I remembered getting the Soundwave for I think I was about five. On my fifth birthday, I got a Soundwave, and I was quite happy about that. So I was quite over the moon, and Transformers was very adhered to my heart. Saw every episode, but one thing that eluded me was, why didn't my father work in the cinema industry for so long? Why didn't he take me to see Transformers? It didn't make any sense until I found it on the in the school holidays. They had it on the 12 o'clock cartoon slot. Like, what? Transformers? Is this Transformers a movie? I watched it and I kind of figured why. Seeing, it wasn't so much just Optimus Prime. But, I mean, if you look at the other main characters who were Autobots that were almost like in almost every episode, you had Brawn, who was he wasn't very big, but he was very strong. We had Prowl, who was the sort of the cop of the Autobots. Ratchet, he used to fix everybody. And my all-time favorite was Ironhide. You know, That's the sort of voice there, Prime. And I absolutely loved, and I loved Ironhide. And just seeing that scene where they all get shot in the jet, you know, as it was leaving one of the moons of Cybertron back to Earth, and that just killed it for me. Absolutely killed it. But I think the highlight of the movie, in my opinion, is the score, because that music by Stan Bush is like the greatest, and it's always cued at the right time of any action sequence. But going back to the sad side of things, it was just the scene when Optimus Prime dies, that music, that score that plays, that heavy, you know, the heavy violins was just, oh, I could hear it now, and I know exactly what that scene is, and probably when I hide my head inside my shirt. But no, it's truly sad. He turns gray, his head turns, and
Yeah,
you
for
know
me, it
that,
was the color change that really hit.
yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But did you know that in America, they actually released it first, and they actually edited the ending for the UK and Australia?
No, I didn't know that. How, what did they do?
Well, what they did was at the end of the movie, you know, after the, you know, you've got the final saying, like, all are one, to all are one. And then
Yeah.
the movie just ends. Whereas in the UK, they said that the greatest Autobot of them all, Optimus Prime, will return.
Oh.
Are you familiar with that scene at the
I
end?
have heard that,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. But they didn't have that in the original American release, and people walked out like with their children crying. My
Yeah, no,
father.
I watched that once as a kid, bawled my way through it, and didn't watch it again until I was, oh God, like 19.
And how old were you when you watched it?
The first time?
Oh, really? Oh, sorry.
Oh God, probably 8
Really?
or
God.
9.
Yeah. See,
Yeah.
I saw it when I was about 13, but when it came out, I was 8. I was 8 myself when it first came out. But I remember my cousin seeing it, and I think when they saw it, they had to go back to their home, like, because they live quite far away from us. I was quite glad because she probably would have spoiled it for me. But she was my younger cousin, who was female, and I'm sure she would have cried more than I did. It'd probably make me cry then, and then it would be like an avalanche of tears. But no, yeah, and I just think that that was, you know, very brave for its time. Like, I don't think I ever watched another cartoon that would actually have that sort of impact. And I know even when the G.I. Joe movie came out, I think 1 or 2 years later, they were implying some deaths in that movie, but they took it out because of the impact that Transformers had, so they didn't kill off any of their characters. So, you know,
Yeah.
yeah, it still scars me to this day.
Me too, obviously, with the refusing to watch
Oh,
it again.
really? Nah. So I can watch it over and over, and I sort of remember almost line for line to a certain
Wow.
degree, yeah.
Yeah, no, I've only watched it twice.
Oh, really?
I loved that. And it was so brutal. Like, it felt like war.
Yeah.
Like, it was just not something I was prepared for.
No. And I mean, even when you look back in the old cartoons, you know, I just love some of the scenes with the characters' interactions, and you know, and you see the guys got shot, but they didn't die. Like, this movie just made it like they were like being shot by some ultra plasmic cannon or something. Like, but you know, I mean, it showed that, you know, my all-time two favorite characters, Starscream and Megatron, are just, you know, are awesome. You know, it proves how awesome they are by killing off the Autobots. But it was sad at the same time. And to any Autobots that I offended, I am truly sorry. So we'll move on to another movie. Or did you have anything else?
I know, but you're
No?
fine.
Okay. All right. So the last movie I wanted to touch on, you know, I guess it sort of brings out the feminist in myself, because I really enjoyed this movie. I enjoyed it like a million times more than I would have enjoyed, like, thought I was going to enjoy it. And that is Wonder Woman. The
Yes.
reason why I liked it, because when you are around a woman who is quite, quite smart or quite strong, you sort of take the back step and you sort of let her do her thing, but you try your hardest to support her. And that's where I got from Steve Trevor, because I think that Steve knew his limits, and then he sees a woman who could do cause a lot more damage than he could, and but he still tried to be the, I guess, the man, if you know what I mean. He still tried really hard to sort of help her, and and I really admired him for that. And I might have gone a bit too far, but I guess the scene that really struck me at first, that actually made who made Wonder Woman into her own, was the death of her auntie or her aunt, because her aunt was her mentor. She was the loose cannon of of the Amazons. She was the one who just thought, you know what, if you've got health, if you've got strength, just fight. Learn how to fight. You never know when it comes in handy. And whereas, Diana's mother is like, oh, I don't think that's a good idea, and she was like doing it on the side, on the down low. She was learning how to fight, and it was interesting though that although the women, well, the Amazons thought they were fighting men, but when they saw Steve on their side or that side of the beach, they sort of thought that he was one of them. And I just loved how Diana just protected him and said, no, he's not one of them at all. And I thought that was really nice. But and my mother, when she saw it, she cried when Steve Trevor died, because it was like he was like the best damsel in distress you could ever
He
imagine.
so was.
Yeah, he was the best damsel in distress that you'd ever come across. And and just seeing him in that line that he said to her, it was muffled at first, but then it became clearer when she was like, she was restricted in that thing that Ares made her, like wrapped her up in that metal. And then things started to come to her, and then she realized what he said. And then when she looks up and she sees his plane explode, like it was a real sad moment in that movie. And yeah, it was that to me was a really sad scene. Even when I look at the YouTube videos, it's sort of like, wow, that's it is really, really sad. It's sad because she could have done that and she wouldn't have been hardly hurt, you know what I mean? But for him, he took his own life to protect her, and he wanted to prove something. He had nothing to give her that, unless he unless she, she he had to do that thing. So yeah, it was really, really sad. But what was your thoughts about the movie in general? Or that
Well,
scene?
I mean, I loved it by like 1,000. Interestingly, my youngest son was also very attracted to Steve. I think that it comes down to is you don't see very many good male allyship roles. And Steve Trevor not just was the damsel in distress, he recognized that she knew better and just let her go. He may have tried to stop her a few times, but he saw he couldn't do it. And in the end, he finally freaking wised up and he did his part that he could do and let her do the part that he knew that she could do. And I think that's really an important reminder to men and women out there because we do have different things that we can do as people. All people have different things that we are more capable of doing. And I think that his death, while a lot of people see that as just motivating in the moment or a sad thing, I kind of saw it as this moment of recognizing just how much she loved him, and not just him, but loving people like him, loving humanity itself. And it was that love, and again, that appreciation that you get after a person dies that allowed her to find what was the strong parts in her. And I think that it's a little unfortunate because it's kind of like a reverse of the girl in the fridge that's
Oh,
the
God.
way it played out.
Yeah.
But I do like the focus on love and support and just trying to make the world a better place through coming together like that.
Yeah. And the touchiness part, well, the really touchy part was at the end when she gets that parcel from Bruce Wayne, and she replies saying, "Thank you for bringing him back to me." That was nice.
Yeah, because he, for her, I don't think that his death was like the end. Her love was still there.
Yeah. And because she's busy, she's probably traveled the world a million times, and she would rather have that sort of that sentimental thing, whether it be just a picture. And yeah, and you felt it in the typing because she sort of studied her keyboard, you know what I mean? It was really, really nice.
Yeah, he's still in her heart
Yeah,
forever and
that's right. Yeah, so, and then that's, I guess, the point to that is, when you do have these pictures, it's really important to think back to the memories of that picture, whether it be a loved one that you've had, who've you lost, or it could be a friend or anything. Just when you do look at those pictures, you should always look back at the memory of what led to that picture. And we saw that in the movie, which was nice. It was, he was proud to be with her. He was really, really proud.
Yeah,
And
it was like a giant memorial to him.
yeah.
The
Yeah. But anyways, just before we wrap up, then we've just got something we need to announce. As there's recent hurricane or storm activity, whether it be including in Texas, Louisiana, the Caribbean, most recently Puerto Rico. People are going without water, without electricity now for weeks, and they really would need, they really do need donations. So if you do have a couple of dollars spare here and there, just reach out to your local community donation center, and just put whatever you can, whatever money you have. It doesn't sound like a lot, but a couple of dollars to those who actually need it would really benefit from it. And our hearts go out to those people who are affected.
Yeah. Again, Wonder Woman would want us to help and love and support.
Indeed, she would. Well, anyways, thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to Grappling with the Graphic. It is an original Undercover Capes podcast. Check out our other amazing content on undercovercapes.com, as well as our parent company, comiccrusaders.com, for all things comic pop culture, for fans, by fans.